Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be back in St. Helens and with you for these four mornings on Judges and Ruth. These are books, of course, which have some profound biblical theology to teach us, and I hope we should do some justice to that. But they're also books which are full of what the Boys' Own comic used to call ripping good yarns. And in these postmodern days that we live in, it's going to be increasingly important that we know how to preach biblical narrative. So that's one of the things that's motivated me in choosing these particular books for our study. Though we shall try to do justice to all the intellectual depth that there is in these books in terms of great biblical theological themes, I also hope that we shall engage in a more personal way with some of the great characters that it introduces to us and clearly expects us to learn just as much from their stories as from the theological context in which their lives are embedded. So we're going to start with the book of Judges this morning and looking more particularly in this first lecture at the biblical theology of the book and the first five chapters of the book under the title Patterns in History. I'm going to read from Judges chapter 2, verse 8, just three paragraphs from the New International Version. This is Judges chapter 2, then, verse 8. Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnath-Heretz, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's command. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshipping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. In the month of August, in the year 410 AD, the city of Rome fell to Alaric the Barbarian. For more than half a millennium, Rome had represented law and order within the vast boundaries of her empire. And this exposure of her vulnerability to the forces of what seemed like blind anarchy sent icy shivers of foreboding across the entire Western world. South of Rome, on the other side of the Mediterranean Sea, stood Carthage, the metropolitan centre of the Roman Empire in North Africa. And not far from Carthage, on the coast, was the harbour town of Hippo. It wasn't long before the refugees began to arrive there. Staggering off the ships, wild-eyed and shabby, they brought horrifying tales of the disaster that had befallen Rome. Tales of famous palaces and gardens now reduced to smoking ruins, of famous senators murdered and noble families exterminated, of sacred virgins raped, and barbarian carts filled to overflowing with plundered treasure, rolling triumphantly south down the Via Appia. Hippo had a famous bishop. Some regard him as the greatest theologian of all time, Augustine. Like everybody else in the town, Augustine was absolutely shattered by the news. It was as if the world itself had been decapitated. They used to call Rome the Eternal City. Clearly now it wasn't. In fact, if Hippo had been shaken by an earthquake measuring 10 on the Richter scale, it wouldn't have produced a greater sense of panic and insecurity. Inevitably, people started to ask why. And not a few of the pagans in Hippo were moved superstitiously to blame the Christians. Rome had fallen, they said, because she had forsaken her traditional gods. This sort of thing would never have happened in the good old days before the Emperor Constantine had been converted to this new-fangled religion of Jesus. And to Bishop Augustine's embarrassment, some of the Christians in his congregation were tempted to murmur in somewhat similar fashion. What had the apostles Peter and Paul achieved for Rome? They cynically inquired. What advantage had the martyrs' graves, which encircled the city of Rome, proved to be? Like the Jews who complained against Moses in the wilderness, Augustine could detect a back-to-Egypt lobby gathering strength in the dark arches of Hippo's basilica. His response was swift. He preached a punchy series of sermons. In those sermons, he insisted that it was not the peevish spite of Jupiter or Juno that had precipitated this disaster. It was rather the judicial wrath of God. Comparing Rome to the ancient city of Sodom, he thundered from his pulpit that God had rebuked Rome for its hedonistic lifestyle and its escapist entertainments. Did the Apostle Peter die in Rome, and was his body buried there in order to safeguard its idiotic theatres and drunken revels? He demanded. No, he answered. This world, the collapse of which you are mourning, is not worth grieving for. Rome burned because it was necessary to make you pause and reflect upon the ephemeral vanity of all material things, he said. God had used Alaric to chasten Rome, that the diseased flesh of her decadent culture should be cut away from the body politic. Well, they were very fine and moving sermons. But was he right? Should such sermons be preached at St. Helen's Bishopsgate? Was Augustine right to analogize the fall of Rome to the fall of Sodom in that way? To draw that line of connection between Bible history and contemporary history? Does history repeat itself in that way? Or is it just historians who sometimes repeat one another? I suspect many of us who are Christians do want to side with Augustine, at least in a sort of gut reaction we do. But of course many academics these days would hold that Augustine was skating on very, very thin ice. C.S. Lewis, for instance, who is far from unsympathetic to Augustine's Christian faith, argues in an essay on the subject that Augustine was actually falling into the very same intellectual trap as the superstitious pagans he was trying to contradict. The trap he calls historicism. A historicist, he says, is a person who believes that it is possible to identify a pattern in history. By far the most outstanding example of historicism among modern thinkers, of course, was Karl Marx. In his doctrine of dialectical materialism, Marx, in a way that one has to agree is somewhat reminiscent to Augustine, believes he can explain why historical events go the way they do. He believed he had discovered, in fact, a scientific law of development within the historical process. The maldistribution of economic power and resources, he said, produces an inevitable class conflict, which can only be resolved by some kind of social revolution. Sadly, while the revolution may change the immediate state of affairs, inevitably new economic equalities arise. So it is only a matter of time before more class conflict leads to yet another revolution. And so the cycle, he said, goes on and on, until, of course, the emergence of socialism. The battle between socialism and capitalism, he said, was the final revolutionary cycle, heralding the arrival of the classless society, a utopian state of permanent peace and justice for all. In his foreword to the Communist Manifesto, Friedrich Engels claims that in this theory of dialectical materialism, Marx has done for history what Darwin's theory of evolution had done for biology. He had elucidated the pattern that enables us to make sense of the past and to predict the future. Well, of course, it is plain to most of us now that Engels rather exaggerated Marx's achievement. There are some scholars who still argue that he was right to see economic conditions as the primary engine of social change, but it is quite obvious from the misery into which just about every society has been plunged, which has tried to adopt Marxism as its political ideology, that Marx's theory of history must be, to say the least, seriously flawed in some respect. According to Karl Popper, a very celebrated philosopher of our century, the flaw is a fundamental one. Marx, he says, was a historicist. And historicism, for all its popularity over the centuries, is, argued Popper, a huge mistake. For the historicists think they have found a pattern in history, but no such pattern exists. Now, it is easy to see the force of this anti-historicist polemic. You don't have to be much of a historian to realize how complicated the web of cause and effect is that lies behind even the most trivial historical event. Marx, for instance, in his obsession with economic factors, completely ignores the role which an outstanding human individual can play in history. According to Thomas Carlyle in his book Heroes and Hero Worship, all history is in fact the story of great men and women, mainly great men according to Carlyle, but then he was a Victorian. And who can doubt that leaders like Alexander the Great or even scientists like Isaac Newton or authors like William Shakespeare, who can doubt that they have influenced the course of human affairs? Yet according to Marxist theory, such greatness is always the product, the artifact of the economic conditions prevailing at the time. It's not hard, I think, to agree with Carlyle that that kind of deterministic view of history grossly underestimates the creative genius of the human spirit or the freedom of the human will. What's more, it's pretty obvious to even a superficial student of history that on occasions the course of human affairs has been directly affected not just by individuals but by what seems beyond question to have been the dictates of pure chance. Bertrand Russell in his book Freedom and Organization cites two brilliant examples of seemingly fortuitous events which had a decisive influence on history. The first he cites is the indecisiveness of the German government in 1917 when it was considering whether to allow Lenin to return to Russia. The grant of an exit visa from Germany to Russia hinged in 1917 on the decision of a single junior minister in the German government. If he had said no, as he might very well have done, the Russian Revolution would have taken place without Lenin. You have to be a very strong-minded Marxist to believe that that wouldn't have made any difference. Russell's other example is from an earlier period. It's Genoa, which ceded Corsica to France in the year 1768. You might think that was a very minor political settlement. I doubt whether you've ever heard of it. But of course, if it had occurred a year later, in 1769, then Napoleon, who was born in Corsica in 1769, would have been an Italian. You can't tell me that wouldn't have made a difference. So whatever our theory of history is, it must be able to take into account the cumulative effect of millions of such random chances and insignificant human decisions. That's why I say it is easy to see why historicism lacks credibility among rigorous thinkers. Popper and Lewis are surely right to insist that history just doesn't obey rigid scientific laws. It doesn't evolve according to some simple rational principle. History is essentially complex, chaotic, unpredictable. And nothing is more dangerous than to think it is not. For most of the acts of political fanaticism that have marred the history of the human race, particularly in the last couple of centuries, have been perpetrated by historicists who were convinced they had understood the pattern of history and that destiny, with a capital D, was therefore on their side. Now, those who look for pattern in history are exploring a blind alley. No such pattern exists. Or does it? Though it is considered in academic circles highly politically incorrect these days, I want to suggest that Augustine was in fact not so mistaken after all. And that the reason Marxism has proven so disastrous to the regimes that have embraced it is not because Marx was in error to look for a pattern in history, but rather that the pattern he found was mistaken. Now, my reason for saying that, you will have anticipated, I imagine, has to do with the Bible, and in particular with this book of Judges that we're going to be studying. Judges is a continuation of the history of Israel, covering the period between the death of Joshua and the beginning of the monarchy. The first section of the book, up to chapter 2, verse 5, sets the scene for what follows. It tells how, in the absence of Joshua, the tribes of Israel attempted to continue their occupation of the land of Canaan. At first, they had some success. But repeatedly, we read that the Israelites failed to follow up the victories God gave them, and thus left residual pockets of Canaanite strength all over their territory. That God was displeased with this lack of tenacity and thoroughness was made plain to the people in an oracle given at Bochim, which concludes this opening section of the book in chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land that I swore to give your forefathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now therefore I tell you, I will not drive them out before you, and they will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. Now, it's not clear to me whether this angel of the Lord was a supernatural figure or a human being. The Hebrew word for angel, of course, means simply a messenger, and it can be used for either human emissaries or supernatural angelic ones. I suspect that in this case the divine message was actually delivered by an unspecified prophet resident in the shrine of Gilgal. He was the messenger of the Lord who went up from Gilgal to Bochim. But whether I'm right about that doesn't really matter. The key thing to note is that God regarded the failure of the Israelites to drive out the Canaanite peoples who had occupied the land before their arrival as a breach of his covenant with them. These Canaanite peoples were, you see, pagan, and their presence therefore posed a spiritual as well as a military threat to Israel's future. The next section of Judges, from 2 verse 5 through to 3 verse 6 spells this out. It elucidates for us the pattern. The pattern which history is going to follow during the period of Judges. And it offers us a theological explanation for this pattern. It tells us in the opening paragraphs that Joshua's death proved to be a watershed. This is the section we just read from 2 verse 8 onwards. Once his generation had passed, a moral deterioration set in among the Israelites. They began to flirt with the pagan idolatry that they had foolishly left in their midst. And this brought with it a downturn in their military fortunes, as we read in that paragraph from verse 10 onwards. But it's at precisely this point that the distinctive feature of the pattern of history, which this book wants to describe to us, becomes apparent. Verse 16, then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of these raiders. Now these judges, after whom the whole book is named, were not generally speaking judicial figures at all. They were charismatically endowed military leaders. We shall meet several of them over the course of these lectures. Suffice it here simply to note that whatever respite the emergence of one of these judges brought to the oppressed Israelites was always short-lived. For as verse 17 goes on, yet they would not listen to their judges. They quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked. So though whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with them and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived, when the judge died, the situation went back to perhaps being even worse than it was at the start. You see then the pattern emerges. A downward spiral in which for every step Israel takes forward, she seems to take 2 backwards. Eventually, says the sacred historian in verse 20, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant that I laid down for their forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. He becomes so exasperated then with Israel's persistent backslidings, he decides to withdraw the opportunity of achieving military security within her borders altogether. The Canaanite peoples instead are to remain as a permanent source of spiritual testing. A testing which, as 3 verse 5 indicates, the Israelites invariably failed to pass. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage, gave their own daughters to their sons, and served other gods. Now that verse brings us to the story of the first of these judges, which the book of Judges tells us about, Othniel. In many respects, the story of Othniel is unusual simply because it has no unusual features. As we shall see in later studies, almost all the judges are highly individualistic, with very distinctive elements in their stories as a result. But our author tells us nothing interesting about Othniel at all. Now that, I suggest you, is quite deliberate. Othniel's story functions as a kind of model or paradigm for all the judges. It comprises a cycle of 7 stages. That's why I've asked this overhead. I'm sorry if there are those of you who can't see it. It would not be disastrous if you can't. Here's the pattern, then. First, in 3 verse 7, spiritual apostasy. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals. Second, 3 verse 8, military oppression. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, so he sold them into the hands of an unpronounceable king of Aram. 3 verse 9, they appeal to God in their distress. They cried out to the Lord. And in the second part of verse 9, stage 4, a spirit-anointed savior appears as a result. And the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Othniel, son of Kenaz. Stage 5, victory over the enemy is secured. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, he went to war, and the unpronounceable king of Aram was overpowered by Othniel. Stage 6, 3 verse 11, temporary peace. The land has peace for 40 years. Stage 7, the Saviour dies. And so in 3 verse 12, you notice, the cycle begins all over again. Here then is the pattern in history I'm talking about. It is a pattern which we observe again and again in this book. Not all the stories of all the judges display all seven of these stages explicitly, but all contain some of them. And Othniel, as I say, represents the pattern in its simplest and most unembroidered form. Our author gives us so little information about him as an individual so as to achieve that simplicity. That he had access to more information, which he could have used about Othniel, we need have no doubt, but he has chosen actually to include that back in chapter 1, verses 9 to 15, so as not to sacrifice the simplicity of this initial paradigm in chapter 3. Now, if you look now on to the next three chapters, you'll see that he moves on to recount two more turns of the spiral. Ehud in chapter 3, verses 12 to 30, and then Deborah in chapters 4 and 5, with the passing mention of a man called Shamgar in chapter 3, verse 31. In each case, the pattern is followed. Indeed, so precisely is it followed that some scholars question the historical accuracy of our author's work simply because it is followed so pedantically. Isn't he, they argue, just a historicist like Marx, who has a theory about how history should go, and so tailors his reportage of the facts so that it conforms? This pattern we have identified, they suggest, is a kind of Procrustean bed, which he cuts every story to fit. Well, I want to resist that criticism of our author's work. He may be a historicist of sorts and see meaning in events. But the pattern he describes is actually a much more subtle and plausible one than that of Marx. For a start, you see, the guiding hand behind this pattern is not some inexorable quasi-scientific law of historical evolution. It is the hand of God, a personal God, who is dealing with us human beings in a thoroughly personal fashion. There is no hint here of fate bearing events on in a remorseless and unalterable tide. No, the conviction of our author is that history is in the hands of a good and just sovereign. If there is a pattern to observe, then, it's because he is dependable in his dealings with us. Thank you very much. If there's a pattern to follow, to observe, it's because he's dependable and consistent in his dealings with us. He's victim to no fickle whims. Like a perfect husband, he's utterly faithful to his promises. Like a perfect judge, he's utterly consistent in his verdicts. But there is nothing mechanical or fatalistic about his decrees. He is a personal God, and he displays personal freedom, therefore, in his actions. Indeed, one of the main goals he has in the way he orders the historical process is to teach his people this truth about his personal character. One way, for instance, which he does this is by injecting a deliberate air of unpredictability into the pattern. Do you notice the time lags, the time intervals between these cycles that he outlines in chapters 3 to 5? There's no discernible pattern there, is there? Oppression 8 years, peace 40 years, oppression 18 years, peace 80 years, oppression 20 years, peace 40 years. I don't see any pattern there. The people had to wait for a long while, and for an unspecified and indeterminate number of years at that, before God intervened to save them. And the duration of the peace that follows is variable too. Now, if you think about it, this is the way it has to be. Some years ago, there was an episode in the sci-fi series Red Dwarf that illustrates the point I want to make rather well. I don't know if you watch this. If you don't, you should be ashamed. It's a major cult influence on a great many young people and older people too these days. The space travellers in this episode of Red Dwarf visit a penal colony on some distant asteroid. Superficially, it seems to be a most enlightened place, an open prison if ever there was one. For there are no cells, no locked doors, no sadistic warders. Instead, this penal colony is surveyed by a highly sensitive and sophisticated computer system. Much the sort of computer system that Bill Gates is keen to invent in Cambridge, so I understand. One that will follow us everywhere, at every corner of our home or work, and constantly be accessible to us and us to it. That's the point of this computer system. It detects immediately any misdemeanor or crime perpetrated by the human inmates and instantaneously administers a painful punishment in retribution. The travellers quickly discover there is no way to evade the vigilance of this perpetual nemesis. And as a result, whether out of conscious fear or Pavlovian conditioning, behavior in the colony is highly controlled and conformist. A bit like some public schools I have visited. And yet, as you will readily imagine, it is also a totally inhuman place, rather like some public schools I have visited. This regime of immediate and inescapable retribution has the effect of destroying all personal freedom far more radically than prison bars ever could. The moral of the episode, which the travellers conclude when they eventually leave, is an interesting one. They conclude there has to be a time lag between crime and punishment, and that the time lag has to be of indeterminate duration. Otherwise, there is no freedom to sin. And if there is no freedom to sin, there's no freedom at all. Isn't that interesting? For it's exactly what we see exemplified in God's dealings with his people in the book of Judges. He wants to teach them that there is a connection between moral behavior and divine blessing. But he wants to teach them this in a way that preserves their human freedom. Hence these erratic time lags between the cycles of the pattern. He enjoys personal freedom of action, and he grants the same precious gift of personal freedom of action to us. That brings me to the second observation I want to make about the way this pattern in history works out in practice. I want you to notice the way God uses individuals as key agents in his purposes. According to Marx, remember, the pattern in history was so rigid, no individual could really have any ultimate effect on events. Things would go the way the laws of dialectical materialism dictated, whether Lenin was there to help the revolution along or not. But our author is not so indifferent to the historical contribution of great leaders. On the contrary, he sees it as part of the pattern. God chooses to raise up such individuals regularly as part of the pattern and achieves his saving purpose through them. And what eccentric and unexpected individuals they sometimes are. That again, you see, is part of the divine stratagem. And what eccentric and unexpected means these unexpected individuals sometimes use. Take, for instance, Ehud, this character we meet in 3 verse 12. Our translation says in 3 verse 15, he was a left-handed man. The Hebrew text is a little less specific than that, in my view. It simply says he had some kind of physical impediment. Parquet to the left-handers here. And as the story later unfolds, it's clear that whilst the only good arm he had was his left, it is likely, I think, that his handicap was much more serious than simply being left-handed. I suspect he was a cripple. That his right arm was totally useless to him. Only that, I think, explains how it was Eglon, king of Moab, was prepared to hold private counsel with him in the absence of his usual bodyguards. That, again, you see, is part of the divine stratagem. And what eccentric and unexpected means these unexpected individuals sometimes use. Take, for instance, Ehud, this character we meet in 3 verse 12. Our translation says in 3 verse 15 he was a left-handed man. The Hebrew text is a little less specific than that, in my view. It simply says he had some kind of physical impediment. Parke to the left-handers here. And as the story later unfolds, it's clear that whilst the only good arm he had was his left, it is likely, I think, that his handicap was much more serious than simply being left-handed. I suspect he was a cripple, that his right arm was totally useless to him. Only that, I think, explains how it was Eglon, king of Moab, was prepared to hold private counsel with him in the absence of his usual bodyguards. Well, you can read the story at your leisure, but quite frankly, Ehud does not strike you as your typical super-spiritual hero. He is a cripple, and he assassinates Eglon by a piece of pretty Machiavellian cunning, concealing a specially prepared short sword on his right-hand side, where, of course, a sword was not normally worn, and thrusting it into the lower body of his victim, thus puncturing the bowel. That at least seems to be the implication of the rather obscurely scatological reference in the Hebrew of verse 22. It's a colourful story, this then, full of human interest and unexpected twists. But thus the divine pattern was achieved. And Israel, for a while, is delivered from her oppressor. Yet I think you'll agree, not in a way that savours of mechanical fate. The same is true of the brief reference to Shamgar in 3 verse 31, a warrior whose exploit was notable not for its left-handed stealth, but its bizarre weaponry. He killed 600 Philistines with some kind of ill-defined agricultural implement. Our translation calls it an ox goad. Well, it may have been an ox goad, whatever it wasn't the kind of thing one conventionally used for personal combat. Perhaps we are to draw the conclusion that the Philistines had disarmed the populace in their conquered territory, so ox goads and the like were the only weapons someone like Ehud could improvise. Even more unusual, though, this fellow was almost certainly not even an Israelite. The name Ehud is probably Hurrian, not Hebrew. And that may explain why our author does not list him as one of the judges. Again, he sticks out as an anomaly in the pattern, disrupting its normal flow. Once again, God is doing his stuff, but not in the kind of way that gives one confidence about future predictions. And of course, even more is that true of the third judge in this series of cycles, who, wonder of wonders, in a culture so unashamedly patriarchalist, is a woman. Indeed, not only is Deborah a woman, but the person who in the providence of God slays Sisera, the cruel Canaanite general who was oppressing Israel with his 900 iron chariots, is also a woman, and a non-Israelite woman. Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. The story, again, is a rather macabre one. We're not told whether she drove the tent peg through the temple of the sleeping general with her left hand or her right. But again, it's a very unusual kind of incident. Do you see what I mean then when I say that though the book of Judges clearly believes there is a pattern in history, it is a very different kind of pattern from that of Mark? It is full of space. Space for human eccentricity. Space for the unexpected surprise. It is the sort of pattern that Israel could recognize with the benefit of hindsight, but never presume upon in any present crisis. For it is a pattern drawn by a personal God who acts consistently in history, but never in such a way as to encourage fatalism or complacency. Now that is, I suggest to you, the kind of pattern that the Bible encourages us to look for in our history too. It was the kind of pattern that Augustine was commenting upon. Of course, the history of Old Testament Israel and that of, let us say, modern Britain are very different in a very fundamental way. Old Testament Israel, according to the Bible, was the chosen people of God. The reason God acted so reliably and frequently in the history of Israel was because he had a special covenant with her, which he was honor-bound to keep. However, it is possible to see this pattern of history that we've discovered in the book of Judges in other areas too. We can see this same kind of pattern in our own lives and in events of our own day, I suggest to you. First of all, this pattern teaches us that God is in sovereign control of all history. We may not always be able to trace his hand. When it comes to this period of the Judges, of course, we have the good fortune of the book of Judges to help us to interpret events. A book written by a prophet who is given divine authority and inspiration to interpret the events he comments upon. Nobody can comment infallibly and authoritatively in that way upon events today. But that doesn't mean the pattern isn't there. We may not always be able to trace God's hand because we don't have an interpretive prophetic word to enable us to do that. His strategies in human history are often very inscrutable. But the book of Judges teaches us this pattern because it wants us to know we can always trust God's heart. As Paul assures us, doesn't he? God is working all things together for good to them that love him and are called according to his purpose. In our day and generation, it is enormously important to teach once again this biblical doctrine of providence. There are many people around who exist in a state of meaningless, who feel that events go nowhere and that there is no pattern for things. There are many others who turn to superstition, who believe in fate, who go to New Age books or the old lady down the road who looks at a crystal or whatever to try to discern some kind of, or reclaim some kind of control over their lives. This biblical view of providence is hugely important to human beings like us, adrift in the sea of time as we are, if we're to have any kind of assurance or peace of mind. A second thing which this pattern teaches us is that human sin will issue sooner or later in judgment. And often that judgment will be temporal in the here and now as well as eternal in the hereafter. Again, it's Paul, isn't it, who talks about the wrath of God being revealed, present tense, against all the godlessness and unrighteousness of the human race. When we see disaster befall a nation, then, it is not inappropriate, as Augustine did, to draw attention to the element of divine chastening and warning and retribution inherent in the situation. In the Old Testament, we find the prophets regularly doing this, not just for Israel, but for the pagan nations too. Jonah, you remember, classically, is sent to Nineveh, a pagan city, with just such an interpretation of events to offer. Jesus himself interpreted a disaster of his own day in this fashion. When the Tower of Siloam fell, he said it was a sign of divine judgment against the world. Interestingly, he was careful not to individualize that judgment, as if those who perished when the Tower of Siloam fell were particularly guilty, more guilty than anybody else. No, he specifically denies that. Rather, he says such events are to be interpreted as general pointers to the coming wrath. They are evidence that God is angry with the world. They are chastening warnings. The pattern then teaches us that human sin will be judged sooner or later, in the here and now, as well as in the hereafter. Thirdly, and rather more sadly though, the pattern in the book of Judges teaches us that the only thing we human beings learn from history is that we do not learn from history. Hegel's famous observation. You would have thought that after three cycles of apostasy and judgment, that Israel would begin to get the message. But no, the book of Judges goes on to recount how the spiral of decadence kept on going down and down. Now Marx, by contrast, was an optimist. He believed history was making progress towards a glorious man-made utopia of the future. And of course there are some Christians who entertain similar hopes, the post-millennialists. But neither the book of Judges nor the book of Revelation, in my view, really gives us solid grounds for that kind of optimism in the present age. Human beings are inveterate sinners, and as a result we must expect that evil men will wax worse and worse, and that there will be wars and rumours of wars till the end of time. In fact, the view of history which the book of Revelation espouses is very similar to the view of history of the book of Judges, a downward, spiralling motion. Many historians, of course, have observed this downward spiralling of history and built their secular histories around such a theory. In the ancient world, Hesiod, the Greek historian, interpreted Greek history this way. Every twist of Greek history was a movement further and further away from the classical age. If you know anything of Chinese historiography, a similar kind of view of history is found there. Every emperor begins with a divine mandate from heaven. Eventually his dynasty falls into corruption, and a new dynasty emerges with a new divine mandate. But the general pattern is still downward. Among modern Western historians, of course, Toynbee is the one who developed this with most erudition, surveying, I think, over 20 civilizations, ancient and modern. He drew this conclusion that there is a cyclical pattern in the history of civilization, and that its overall direction is always downwards. Fourthly, however, and more optimistically, this pattern in Judges does encourage us to believe that God, in his mercy, will respond to the prayers of his people when they are willing to confess their sins. Furthermore, it suggests that frequently the way in which he will inject new hope after a period of distress is by raising up a leader. There is a very, very strong doctrine of leadership in the book of Judges. In national history, of course, this leader may be a politician. Maybe some of us would want to say Winston Churchill was raised up in just such a fashion in response to the prayers of people in this country. In church history, it may be a great evangelist like John Wesley or George Whitfield, who is used by God to turn the tide of spiritual declension and bring about revival. In the history of individual churches too, it is not difficult to detect how the variations in the fortunes of a church congregation with history are tied to the particular leadership that church enjoys at any particular moment. It seems that God puts a lot more store by the contribution of the exceptional leader than Marx allowed. And fifthly and finally, we learn from this book of Judges that no human deliverer can ever fully meet our need. For whilst the judge appears and some temporary remission is granted from the downward spiral, it is only a temporary remission, never a total reversal of the pattern. And for one very good reason. The judge always dies. Did you notice the emphasis which the narrator gives to that sad truth? So long as the judge lives, everything gets better again. But then he dies and we're back to square one. It's the story every time as you read the history of these judges. While the judge lives, there's peace and security, then deterioration once he's gone. And the people then have to wait decades upon the gracious providence of God before another judge brings security and peace once again. Now, of course, eventually the people of Israel tried to escape this state of being hostage to death by appointing a dynastic monarch. That's one of the forces that drives the period of Judges in the direction of monarchy, to escape the uncertainties that arise because judges are a finite lifetime. Once the dynastic monarch is on the throne, once the king dies, there's always a successor in line, you see. But as, of course, the books of Samuel and Kings go on to recount, that was no real solution either. Because there is no guarantee that that successor would be the kind of godly person the Spirit of God would be pleased to anoint and bless. So in the later history of Israel, as often as not, it is the kings, the leaders, who are the very ones who lead the people into idolatry, ironically. So the hard truth is, you see, that no human leader can really meet our needs. If they do nothing else wrong, they always eventually die. But of course, by teaching the Israelites that pattern in history, God was preparing them for a leader yet to come who would not die. We're going to be looking at the stories of some fascinating characters later on today and next week, Gideon, Samson, and Jephthah. None of them are perfect men by a very long chalk. But each of them in his own way does prepare the ground for the true judge and the true saviour, Jesus. We'll stop there for coffee.